Indeed.
Indeed.
Trikunya.
The three modes of nature.
Vishayaha. Possessing as objectives.
Trigunya.
The three modes of nature. Vishayaha. Possessing. Three modes. Trigunya. Possessing as objectives. Yeah. That's the one. Possessing as objectives.
Possessing as objectives.
Mune. O great sage. Yaha.
Which.
Asau.
That.
Alina prakritehe.
Of one who is not freed
from the clutches of Maya.
Aguna sargaha.
In which there is a creation of material bodies.
Puna
punaha.
Again and again.
Translation, O great sage Shukadev Goswami, unless the living entity is freed from the infection of the material modes of nature, he receives different types of bodies in which to enjoy or suffer, and according to the body he is understood to have various inclinations. By following these inclinations, he traverses the path called Pravritti Marg, by which one may be elevated to the heavenly planets as you have already described in the third canto. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. As Lord Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita in the 9th chapter, text 25, Yanti deva vratan devan pritrin yanti pritrin vataha bhutani yanti bhuteja Yanti madhyashino pimam. Those who worship the demigods take birth among the demigods. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. Those who worship ancestors go to the ancestors, and those who worship me will live with me. Because of the influence of the various modes of nature, the living entities have various tendencies or propensities, and therefore they are qualified to achieve various destinations. As long as one is materially attached, he wants to be elevated to the heavenly planets because of his attraction to the material world. The Supreme Personality of Godhead declares, however, that those who worship me come to me. If one has no inclination or no information about the Supreme Lord and his abode, one tries to be elevated only to a higher material position. But when one concludes that in this material world there's nothing but repeated birth and death, he tries to return home, back to Godhead. If one attains that destination, he need never return to this material world, yat gatva, nativartante tadama padama mama. As Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majalila, 19th chapter, text 151, Brahmanda brahmate kona bhagyavan jeev guru krishna prasade poi bhakti lata bij. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems, and some are going down into the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one is very fortunate. He gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service. All living entities are rotating throughout the universe, going sometimes up to the higher planetary systems and sometimes down to the lower planets. This is the material disease, which is known as Pravritti Marg. When one becomes intelligent, he takes to Nivritti Marg, the path of liberation, and thus instead of rotating within this material world, he returns home back to Godhead. This is necessary. Pravritti lakshanaschaiva trigunya vishayo mune yosavalina prakriter guna sarga puna punaha. So om gada timaranda shaganjana shalakaya chakshurun miditam yena tasmai shigurve namaha. So talk about this verse a little bit. So we have two words, pravriti and nivriti. And so let's actually describe what these words mean. It's very interesting. Both words have as their suffix. Suffix means the part that comes after the prefix, for those of you who don't know. Prefix is the first part of the word. Suffix is the last part of the word. Got it? Okay. We learned something today. So both words have their suffix, the word, the word vritti. So the word vritti is a very interesting word. And we have a similar word in English from which this word comes, because Sanskrit, English are both Indo-European languages. Indo-European languages are like English, and of course, you also have, Spanish, Italian, Latin. Actually, Italian comes from Latin. And these are all Indo-European languages. There's other languages that are not Indo-European, like Fijian. Aborigine language. They're not Indo-European. But Sanskrit is actually the source of many languages in Europe. Actually, one thing that's interesting. Let me describe this before I go further into the word vritti. Is that when Sanskrit was first analyzed by a English philosopher and linguist named Henry James, he actually made an interesting discovery. He said, this language of Sanskrit is actually more sophisticated than Greek or Latin. And so when he made that observation, he's quite an educated chap. Actually, in the old days in Europe, people used to be much more educated than they are now. Like you read about these people in Europe like 200 years ago or something like that, they knew like three or four languages. It's not like nowadays someone's educated, they can just speak English. But in those days, people knew a lot of languages, like these great philosophers. Anyway, so when he made that discovery, it shocked the people in Europe. Why did it shock the people in Europe? Because they were cultural chauvinists. You know what a cultural chauvinist is? No. They think, hey, how can all these people, these primitive people in India, have a more sophisticated language than us? It's not possible. They said, because, we're the pinnacle of creation here. We're the Europeans. There's always a lot of European chauvinism. So therefore, they concluded, the only way they could have this language that's more sophisticated than our languages, our root languages like Greek or Latin like that, is that actually we must have gone there in the past to civilize them. In other words, it's our people who went there in the past. And that's where this whole theory, if you study Indology, of the Aryan invasion theory started. You've heard about that before? That means the people from Europe went to India, and of course they said, well, they made a big mistake when they went to India because they happened to get married to some of the Indian people. So, therefore, the skin color changes a little bit. But it's actually our people who came up with this philosophy, which is really interesting, because there was no way they could compute that something that sophisticated, that advanced, had come from India. And also it really threatened their Christian beliefs too. Because, there was a philosophy better than Christianity, which didn't have much philosophy anyway at that particular juncture. So then they came up with this whole Aryan invasion theory, and they said, well, one time we went there, we got married, and now it's our business to go and save our forefathers, or at least the descendants of our forefathers, and just save the land of India. Of course, they saved the land of India by economically exploiting them, which is an interesting way of saving people, isn't it? How can you save people by exploiting them? Anyway, that was their conception. The British, for example, did such wonderful things like cutting off the thumbs of the weavers so that people in India would have to order their cloth from England. There's the whole concept of white man's burden there. Okay, so Anyway, so English and Latin and practically all the European languages other than the Hungarian language and language Finno-Hungarian group, which is a language group in Europe, practically all of them came from Sanskrit. Their roots are from Sanskrit. So the word vritti, getting to the point, the word vritti actually is very similar, or actually the source of many words in English, just like the word or the suffix vert comes from that in English. So in English you have things like invert, right? And of course if someone is very nice, we call them a pervert, right? You heard that word? Pervert. Pervert, invert, subvert, right? And so the word vert means, if you take the root in Latin, it means to turn, basically turn. So the word vritti means to turn. So like you have invert means, you know, turn upside down or backwards or something like that. Pervert means someone, anyway, you get it, you know what it means. Someone who's turned against the normal life. So this vritti word means the turning. So what is the turning? The turning in this material world is, there's many types of turning. Of course, there's this samsara. Samsara means what? Repeated birth and death. So you're turning from one life to another and going through various experiences in which you're learning different things, or various experiences in which you're getting tortured and you're learning various things. It's like, until you come to the conclusion that what? Dukkhalayama Sashvatam. That this material world, you know, all the arrangements I've made, they just don't work. You know, we make so many arrangements in this world, and it's, you know, Prahlad Maharaj describes the arrangements in this world that we make to try to avoid distress give us more distress. You understand? That's what Prahlad Maharaj says. So we've been turning life after life, and finally we come to the conclusion, as Prabhupada indicates here, I ain't got no satisfaction, as the song goes, 1960s, you know, you've heard that song before? Rolling Stones, yeah. Ain't got no satisfaction. And then you cry out to Krishna. And you say, Krishna, Krishna, you know, please help. I've had it. I'm fried out. Finished. Isn't it? And then Krishna sends Guru. And the Guru says, all right, you called? It's like, you know, if you call someone on the, you call 911. Oh, here you don't have 911. What is the emergency number? What? Triple zero. Here he called 000, and all of a sudden, you know, the emergency people show up at your door. So in the same way, we call 000 spiritually, and Krishna's representative shows up and at the door and says, hey, I got some information for you. And, of course, as Prabhupada says, by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, one gets the bhakti lata, the creeper of devotion, because the devotion is actually what will make us happy. We're thinking other things will make us happy, external things. Like, you know, I'm thinking like a computer, nice, you know, Macintosh computer will make me happy. It's a very fancy aluminum body, unibody, aluminum body, Macintosh with a fancy touchpad. You know, you can touch it with three fingers or four fingers. You know about this. You have a Macintosh too, right? You have an old one. You're very unfortunate. You're very unfortunate.
Time for a new one.
Time for a new one. So I'm thinking that this, you know, this is going to make me happy, you know, some nice, cool Macintosh. Or someone's thinking some nice, cool car, you know, like a, you know, different types of cars, like a Maserati or something like that. Or a Porsche. You have these cars here? So we're going externally. All these things, you know, we're thinking, and of course these things, as Krishna says in the Gita, Vritam Gyaname Tena Gyanina Nichabhayana, Kama Rupena Kunti Adusprena Lenichai, after, it just makes us more unhappy. In the beginning, it's like, it seems to make us happy, but then after Christmas morning is over, you know, we've opened up our gifts and, you know, played with them a while, then we get more miserable because there's more things to take care of. Yeah, then you get the credit cards, then you get more miserable. So it's something like that. You know, just like I travel and I have all these little electronic gadgets I travel with, and then, but it's just like I'm always thinking, is something that gets stolen, you know, and go through customs, go through the security check, and so many things. Anyway, it's like a burden. But, you know, we're doing this for Christmas service. I understand that. So one comes to that conclusion after some time. But some people, they take a long time to come to that conclusion, and they think, well, it's not so nice in this Earth planet, but maybe I should try another planet. Just like, you know, Star Trek or something like that. So there's a Vedic version of Star Trek that you can go to other planets, and it's actually much more practical because we haven't yet discovered how to do... Anyone ever see Star Trek? No. How to do Warp 3 or Warp 5, you know. So there's a better way to go to other planets than, you know, with Scotty, you know, there's only Warp 3, you know, anyway, fire up the engines. So there's a better way, which is just simply to transfer yourself to a different body. Because if you really want to go to another planet, you got to have a body that actually fits on the other planet. Otherwise, it's very artificial. Just like if you want to go into the ocean and associate with the fish, I mean, somehow other people like that, then it's very uncomfortable to go with a scuba tank. And, you know, it's called Aqualung. Scuba tank and mask and everything like that. I mean, you can go down for some time. Just like when I was young, I used to go diving all the time. You got to be so careful. Like if you go down too far, you get nitrogen narcosis. Everyone's ever heard of that before? No, that's not the bends. You actually start to go laugh like crazy. It's like intoxication. What? No. I experienced that on this planet. So anyway, in real life, you start laughing like crazy. But you actually get down, and when you go down to like 100 feet, and many people experience this, that you start laughing so much, and you think everything is so funny, you take off your mask. Anyone's ever heard about this? Anyone ever go scuba diving here? You've heard about it, right? Yeah, people take off their mask, and they start, you know, just giggling. Of course, they die. That's called nitrogen narcosis, you know, when you get intoxicated like that down there. And then if you come up too quickly, what happens? Then you get the bends. And they have to put you in a pressure chamber for some time. So bends are very painful. I don't know if any of you have the bends. I mean, all your joints, it's like arthritis multiplied by 10 million to have the bends. And it's very artificial. You know, you're just down there. You can't really associate with the fish or talk their language or anything like that. So in order to really understand and enter into the atmosphere of the ocean, you have to take a body like that. Otherwise, it's uncomfortable. So in other words, if you really want to associate with the fish, you got to be a fish. That's all right. Many people would like that. There's no problem. Or if you want to, let's say if you really want to exchange mellows with your dog. Like rasa, you know, the Prabhupada says you can only exchange rasas, you know, mellows, you know, taste or emotional stuff, with someone in the same species. You can't. Otherwise, I mean, how can you understand a dog unless you happen to be very spiritually astute? I mean, just like you're thinking the dog loves you, but basically the dog is probably just tasting the salt on your body. Like if you go to India, people die, dogs come out, and they eat the body, right? And the part they like the most is the nose. That's the tastiest part. So your dog is just tasting you, getting an appetizer. You're thinking it's love, but he's thinking, you know, delicious. Can't wait till the guy dies.
At least he wipes that long.
Sometimes they don't. You know, that like Doberman pinchers, and they don't even wait that long. They eat the little babies sometimes. So if you really want to have like a loving relationship with the dog, there's a way to do it. We're not objecting. There's actually a way to do it. You have to become a dog, right? And you can do that. And you know, some people we approach and we say, aren't you afraid you become a dog in the next life? And other people say, and those people sometimes say, no, it would be nice, you know, sitting down, watching TV all day long, having food brought to me. In America, at least, the dog is the master of the house, the king of the castle, right? I don't know about here. Probably too. So anyway, the person is thinking like that. So you can become a dog. So, but in the Vedic system, there's even a better alternative. You know, if one's into pravriti marg. Pravriti marg means keeping the turning going, basically. We talk vritti means to turn. Pravriti means to keep it going. Like prakriti rupena jayate is Sanskrit. Keep more turning, more turning. That basically, that's what pravriti marg means. So in the Vedic system, you have the alternative of going to the heavenly planets. And that's a heck of a lot better than being a dog or a cat or a fish. Because in the heavenly planets, I mean, these are great planets. Even most religions, they talk about going to heaven, isn't it? And they, you know, let's go to heaven. You know, we got these wings. We can fly like angels. You know, like you see some of the pictures in Italy, isn't it? The angelic host. They're flying around. I think it would be cool to fly around all the time like that with nice wings. I wouldn't want to be a cherubim. You know what a cherubim is? That's a little kid, anyway. like you see on these fountains sometime. There's a little kid, and he's passing urine, the water's coming out of the... That's what a cherubim... That's also described in heaven, they have those things. But in the Vedic system, in the Vedas, there's actually an elaborate description of heaven. And it's really cool. I mean, you can fly around. You have automatic mystic powers. Everyone there is, you know, you don't have to worry about eating raw food there, because everything there, everyone's healthy, and everything is cooked in ghee in the heavenly planets. Now, in, you know, in this planet, if you start to eat things cooked in ghee, then you get sick. You know, fried foods, cooked food. That's why we have this new sampradaya, the raw foods. The cyclic succession, Joe and myself, you know, we're going to convert everybody. So, but in the heavenly planets, you know, the bodies are actually more subtle, so they can do things. They can eat food cooked, you know, fried foods and sweets all the time. There's no diabetes, no arthritis, no rheumatism, no swine flu up there. It's pretty good, isn't it? And you keep your hair, you know, it's always black or blonde or whatever, you know what it is. No wrinkles, no plastic surgeons, there's no work for doctors up there.
So what do doctors do?
What doctors do, they don't go to heavenly planets, you know. They take birth here on this level. But there's no room for doctors. I mean, even they have one, the gurus are so expert that even if you do die, they can bring you back to life. Is when Shukracharya, you know, people die. He's even the guru of the demons, and people come back to life. So there's no need of any of those things. So it's really, and then it's like being on constant vacation all the time. That you get, you know, everyone's beautiful. I mean, the ladies there are so beautiful. They make the ladies here look like frogs. You know, once you got, no offense to any of you ladies, but, and the men are so handsome, the men here look like cockroaches in comparison. So you've got to be equal in this description here. I can't commit any offenses. So anyway, so an equal offender. I'm an equal offender, you know. So it's great. And you live such a long life. So what's the problem? You know, what's the problem with going there? Why don't we just like do the Vedic thing, you know, the sacrifices, the yajnas. And actually that's the Karma Mimamsa people. There's a branch of the Vedic philosophy called the Darshan, one of the Darshans called Karma Mimamsa. That's what they believe. That's the goal. You know, perform sacrifices. Even if there are gods, they're not that important. Even if God's there, it's not that important. A god or gods or whoever there is just has to function under the law of karma. That's karma mimamsa. So anyway, so people go to the heavenly planets and they enjoy. So what's the problem there? There's many problems. That's one of the problems, is that when your good karma runs out, shine punya marcha lokam vishanti, you come back here and you have to go back to work. It's like you go on vacation, spend your money, come back, go to work again, right? I mean, you can't stay on vacation all the time because you've got to spend some time making money, which is most of the time. So that's, and then you got to come back and do some more sacrifices, swaha, 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 Agnihotra sacrifices, you got to give charity. I mean, it's a real pain. And then you go back up there, and not only is it temporary, but you're in anxiety because it's time's running out. You know, you're just looking at your watch and just, oh, I got 1 hour left in the heavenly planets. And when time runs out, your garland wilts, you start to get ugly, and then you fall down again. Anyway, and then another thing is there is some anxiety because other people are envious. Like when in this material world, when you have power or position, what happens? People become envious. Like that. I mean, really envious. We got to be careful. We got to be careful. You know, people get really envious. It's like many years ago, I got a real fancy car as a devotee, you know, a real fancy car. And then I was driving up, you know, doing spiritual programs, and people going, what's he have? Fancy car on sannyasi. Fancy car. So then I traded it in, and now I just have a Honda. So anyway, that's better anyway. So people get it. So what to speak of, you're in the higher planets. There's this whole group of people who are envious of you. They're called demons. And they're always trying to take over, you know, and attack you. And they got some heavy weapons there. And you always got a defense. You're always in anxiety. They're coming. They're coming to take you away, as the song goes. They're coming to take away heaven. And that happens sometimes. Even the demigods, like Indra, he becomes displaced from heaven. There's that story, Indra got displaced from heaven, his mother had to save him. You know what happened? His mother prayed, and then she gave birth to Lord Vamanadeva. Lord Vamanadeva had to take back everything and put Bali Maharaj in the prison. Anyway, he made Bali Maharaj a great pure devotee at the same time. So that's another problem. But I think the main problem in the heavenly planets is you're not really happy. Because the happiness, real happiness, comes from bhakti or loving exchanges. It doesn't come from having a nice vacation in the heavenly planets. Just like I was in Fiji, and one time I have one person I'm helping become Krishna conscious, and you know, a very wealthy lady, and she took myself and a group of people, some of us, went to this beautiful island there where, you know, the vacation island you've seen? What's that? No, right off of Lotoka. Yeah. Anyway, the castaways or something like that, where everything was perfect. You know, beautiful beach, nice bar. We didn't drink, of course. Nice bar and beautiful people and everything like that. It was boring. It was actually extremely boring after about 5 minutes. So because the real pleasure, the real nectar, the real happiness is actually loving exchanges. It's not how much food you put in your belly, how many material goods you have, but loving exchanges. And loving exchanges can only be had when one is completely pure. Because if one is not completely pure, so-called loving exchanges are business arrangement, right? I scratch your back and you scratch mine. Let's make a deal. Right? Make a deal. Let's see if we're compatible. It's a business arrangement. Unless one is pure. You know, unless one actually loves. What does it mean to love the other person or persons? It's just like only be interested in their welfare and not your welfare. So, and of course that is accomplished with Krishna consciousness. So that's the Nivritti Marg. Now Nivritti Marg means to stop the turning. Basically, to stop all this turning, go up to the heavenly planets. Like we said, Pravritti Marg means to continue or even augment the turning. So Krishna consciousness, that is, you know, bhakti, which is mentioned here, the bhakti lata bij, the bij or the creeper or the seed of devotion or love, that actually comes from Krishna's representative, the spiritual master. And once it's implanted in the heart and we practice the process of bhakti, which is basically hearing and chanting, it grows more and more, and we become happier and happier. That's the point. Even if the material world is falling apart around us, And even if it will fall apart around us, that's the way things are in this world, isn't it? Because you are going to get old. You are going to get sick. You are going to die. Things will fall apart, I guarantee. And so even if things are falling apart, you can tolerate because you have that loving exchange in your heart. Just like, I mean, I gave the example, not here, but somewhere else, that in my service to Srila Prabhupada, you know, sometimes we have to deal with really stressful things. Like, I have a very big GBC zone. So my responsibilities go all the way from parts of Europe. Unfortunately, I didn't get Italy. I get the countries right next to Italy, which are really challenging countries, you know, like Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro, Bosnia, where else? Slovenia. Slovenia's all right.
Why are they so challenging?
Because there's a culture of fighting there.
Are still there today?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They had major fights like 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, I thought they were pretty much settled down now.
Well, settled down at gunpoint. But anyway, I mean, so dealing with that, there's major things going on there, even with the devotees, because they're part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Or you go to Fiji, and it's also interesting interactions there, to say the least. You know, I'm not going to get into the details. Oh, it's not that I want sympathy either. But interesting interactions there. You know, America, there's other types of interesting interactions. And so, you know, sometimes it just really bombards you, all the things happening. And as I travel, I have to be, like, in contact with all these things simultaneously. You know, you all think I'm here, but I'm not here in Australia right now. I'm actually, you know, my mind is divided up all over the material world.
Australia is the most relaxing, I imagine, for you.
Yeah, it's actually, I don't have to be involved in any politics or anything like that. It's just I can be a Hare Krishna devotee here. So, but still, even if I'm here all around the world, these things are just coming to me by the mercy of email and electronic media. So therefore, but how do we cope with this? We actually think that our real happiness is in our loving exchange with Krishna. And these other things, that'll happen, you know. That's life. Whatever's happening now, you know, whatever distresses I'm experiencing in my service, because I'm doing it for spiritual purposes, that will help me advance in spiritual life. Whatever distress occurs to us, we can use as a stepping stone. As they say, no pain, no gain, you know, right? No pain, no gain. So there's something to be learned, that's all. Something to be learned. More tolerance, more love. I mean, and the hardest thing is to actually love someone who is actually causing you pain. You know, the love like that. And that is actually, of course, we spoke about that the other day. That is actually a very advanced stage. But so in other words, if one is experiencing ecstasy, spiritual happiness from within, then the material happiness or distress are not that important anymore. You understand? Sukha dukkha, either happiness or distress. In one sense, it's easier to tolerate distress than it is happiness. Because when you get happiness, you become all, what, bewildered. Everything's so great. You know, nice weather outside, everybody's smiling at me, nice food, I'm healthy. You become bewildered, right? So happiness is harder to tolerate than distress. Because in happiness, there's a problem. Anyway, so let's discuss this. So according to the Vedic system, one can go to the heavenly planets. That's the Pravritti Marg. We're advised to take up the Nivritti Marg. And Nivritti Marg means not only to stop the turning, but to actually become renounced from this material world. But renunciation occurs when one has a higher taste or a higher pleasure. And that higher taste or higher pleasure is the loving exchanges one can experience in Krishna consciousness. That's the higher taste. Not just, you know, sweet balls and halva and pakoras and things like that. The higher taste is the loving exchanges. So anyway, so that's some of the points. So any questions or comments? Yeah.
Raj, you were talking about how you had an expensive car that people would be very envious.
Yeah.
What about, for say,
Your car is not expensive. Don't worry about it. No one will become envious of your van.
No, I'm just saying, what about Grihasthas who are, like, doing direct preaching all the time and wearing their robes constantly, having, like, an expensive...
That's fine. I'm not saying that someone shouldn't do those things. I'm just saying people do get envious. That's all. That was my only point. But a sannyasi especially has to be careful. Because a sannyasi's preaching is based upon his reputation. And if there's one little spot in a sannyasi, you know, or perceived spot in a sannyasi, he can't preach effectively, isn't it? Just like, I mean, for example, if, you know, you're out reading books tonight, and then you see me go into, what, a multiplex? You know what, you have a multiplex is here? You don't know what a multiplex is. The other devotees understand what a multiplex is. What is a multiplex?
Movie theater,
but not an ordinary movie theater. It means a multiplex is a movie theater with, like, at least, you know, 5-10 different screens in it. It's not just an ordinary movie theater.
That's all our movie theaters.
Oh, all your... Fiji, they have regular movie theaters, you know.
Yeah, but we also have the ones where you have luxuries, you have reclining chairs.
Oh, really?
You know, individual, and you pay extra for them. You get table service, food, and everything delivered to you.
Wow.
That's what I thought you were trying
Let's
to
go tonight. So, if you see, for example, if you see me going into one of these theaters, whatever you call it, here in Australia, then... Next time you're sitting in Bhagavatam class, you may not even go to Bhagavatam class, but anyway, you'll be thinking, huh? You won't be paying so much attention, right? You won't be. So my preaching, my activities have become hindered as a sannyasi if people actually can find fault. Of course, there's always fault to find, but the point is we don't want to give more opportunities to people than necessary. So as a sannyasi, I have to be careful about that. The grihasthas, that's a little bit different. You understand? A little bit different for grihastha life. But sannyasi has to be vairagya vidya. People have to see, in order for me to practically execute my service, people have to see that I'm basically renounced from the world.
Like one saying that you want to be unattached to material things when you drive around a Ferrari sports car.
Yeah, I mean, for you it's all right. But for me, it would be a disaster.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's good for one is not good for another person. Everybody has a different ashram. So for me to drive, you know, let's say I pull up my preaching engagement here, you know, not even Ferrari, Maserati, or something.
They're trying to convince people that material existence is unimportant.
Yeah, I said, this material world is suffering, everything is, you know, it's Maya. Yeah.
And you ask us for donations.
Yeah. Or I show up with earrings on, you know, gold earrings and gold chains hanging down from my... I mean, it won't be so effective. For grihastha, it's fine. I mean, so everybody is different. But anyway, the real point I was making is if you have things in this world, people do get envious. And the heavenly planets, that's what happens. I mean, that was the point. I'm not speaking against material opulence. I'm speaking about, you know, the envy the people experience.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, and people get envious. They just look at me and they get envious. So that's what happens in the heavenly planets. So we should cultivate, whatever position we're in, we should cultivate love of Krishna. That's the point. Stani sita shruti katam tan ban manobir. Just hear and chant about Krishna, whether you're a sannyasi, a grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, or a Mataji, or a Pitaji, or a Babuji. Or a Kakaji, or a Mamashri. These are all Hindi terms for different relatives.
When we lose our position in our heavenly planets, as you were saying earlier, we have to come back to Earth to go to work, as you said earlier, do you get to choose what your karma would be coming back to this existence if you were...
Usually you come back in a relatively good position when you come from the heavenly planets.
Okay, so you don't end up with the same karma that you went there in the first place.
When you went there, you had good karma.
Yeah, well, ultimately, yeah.
But you use up your good karma, and it's sort of like your bank account goes to zero at that point. So you get the opportunity to work more. You get another job as soon as you get down.
But it's a better job.
It depends. See, the real problem, another problem that I didn't point out is that you may come down with all good intentions.
Right.
You may have all good intentions. But the interesting thing about the modes of nature in this world is they're a continual struggle for control of you. There's three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance. And so you may think, I want to stay in goodness. Just like in this part of the Bhagavatam, there was one nice person, he's called Ajamil. He was in goodness. But then he saw something that disturbed his mind. What did he see? He saw, you know, a boyfriend and girlfriend, you know, embracing each other and anyway, having illicit sex. And it disturbed his mind. He started to concentrate and then he fell into ignorance from that point. Another thing, even if one's in the heavenly planets, one can fall into ignorance.
Even up there,
just like Indra. I mean, let's take the example of Indra. He's like one of the main people who have issues, problems. Indra sometimes, he looks down, and some of the ladies here, I guess, are not looking completely like frogs. But anyway, so he looked at, there was one time a sage, his name was Gotama Rishi. He had his wife Ahalya. And so Indra looked down at him, and at her, and said, wow. You know, because if one has everything in the world, still you want more. It's interesting.
Even in that position.
You're completely happy. The more you have, the more you want.
Okay.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, you're satisfied. It's like throwing gasoline on a fire. The more you throw, the further it gets inflamed. So Indra looks down upon this lady, you know, Ahalya, and he says, wow. And he has all these beautiful girls up there, you know, really amazing personalities, Urvasi and all these apsaras, and they all dance for him every day, you know. He sits on his throne, you know, his Vyasasana or whatever it's called, and he just goes like this, and all the girls, you know, whatever they do. I don't know. I've never been there, so I don't really know. You know, anyway, and they, you know, they're doing, if you see in Bollywood film, you understand what I mean. They're all dancing for him. But, you know, but he thinks, you know, maybe this other one has something and the other ones don't. I mean, which is really interesting. Just like, what's that story, 1001 Arabian Nights? The guy would get married one night, you know, one night and he'd kill the lady the next day. Get married the next day. Did you ever hear that story?
No.
No one's ever read that story? Famous story. It's called Scheherazade. And finally, one lady figured out she didn't want to get killed. So she kept telling stories to keep him in entertained. No one's ever heard of that? It's very famous. Very. What? 1001 Arabian Nights. There was a whole movie about it. Even the, it's a kid's movie, I think. It's a kid's movie. Because she didn't want to get killed. And then, of course, then in England, and you probably know about this, you have Henry VIII. Henry VIII got tired of one wife, Anne Boleyn. And at that time, there wasn't a divorce was allowed. You know the story, right?
He got beheaded instead.
Yeah, he said, well, can't get a divorce. You know, got to be religious, so let's cut your head off instead. You know, that's a nice religious thing to do, cut your wife's head off. But and so, and then after that, you know, he did develop his own church, which is the Anglican Church. In America, it's called the Episcopalian Church. And then, because he had his own church, he was able to divorce some of his wives and kill some of them. So he had different ways of getting rid of wives. So Indra, let's get back to the point of Indra. Indra was something like Henry VIII, but in a more sophisticated way. So he looked down, he saw this lady, Ahalya, and he said, wow. He said, she's really nice. I have to have her. And so, but he was afraid of her husband. Her husband was a sage, and sages in those days could curse you. You know, they could really cause problems in your life. They could curse you and destroy you. So even Indra's afraid of Brahmins, you know, spiritual people. So he comes down to the earth planet, waits until the Gotama Rishi, who's the sage, goes to the river to bathe himself, and then Indra is able to transform his body into different forms. So he made himself look like Ahalya's husband, Gotama Rishi. And so he, you know, changes his form like that. And then he walks in and he says to Ahalya, he says, hi, baby, you know, whatever. I don't know what he said, but it's something like that, you know, in a more sophisticated way. You know, and she knew it wasn't her husband because, you know, you can tell, a wife can tell, even if someone looks like her husband, she can tell the difference. You know, it's pretty easy. So anyway, so they had a relationship, and Indra walks out of the house, you know, and looks around, and he's still in the form of the sage. And then as he walks out of the house, the sage happens to come back at the same time. The sage looks at him, does a double take. You know, double take means like, huh? Looks at him and says, am I there or am I here? And then he realizes, that's Indra, and he just had an affair with my wife. So what he did at that point is he cursed Indra. And he cursed Indra basically to become a eunuch. You know, so Indra, poor Indra, you know, he lost his masculinity at that particular juncture. So here's someone in the heavenly planets, he has everything, but still he's looking after something that one of the paupers have on the earth planet. So there's no end to desires, in other words. Even if you go up there, you're still haunted, I want more and more and more. There's no end to it. You know, just like, yeah, I mean, just like I got a nice Macintosh here, I'm thinking, you know, I want a bigger computer, you know, I want a more powerful one. This one doesn't have enough power, a bigger hard disk or something like that. So that happens. It happens. So anyway, so that's life in the material world. But when one takes the Krishna consciousness, one becomes very satisfied. Just like I'm thinking all the time, when can I go to Govardhan and sit down just by Govardhan Hill and just chant? You know, so that's the real happiness. Not these other things. Other things are just like phantasmagoria, basically speaking. I'm thinking, when can I go there and say goodbye, world, you know, and just go, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and then if the mobile phone rings, just smash it, you know. Take a hammer, boom, boom, boom. I don't have to listen to you anymore. Boom, boom, boom. You know, so because that's real happiness. It's inside. Happiness is within inside, actually. It's not out there. It's actually from the heart. Yayatma supersedite. Savai pumsam paro dharma yato bhakti ad hoksaje. Ahoitakiya pratyata yatma supersedite. Anyone know this verse? What actually satisfies the self is bhakti or love. And we're all looking for that. Loving exchange with Krishna and loving exchange with Krishna's parts and parcels. We want that pure relationship with people. We don't want to exploit, and we don't want to be exploited. And that's what impressed me about Prabhupada. When I met Prabhupada, he was someone who loved me. He was coming and helping me, but he had no ulterior or personal motive in doing so. It's not that Prabhupada wanted something from me, he wanted to give. And that's what convinced me to join the Krishna consciousness movement. Otherwise, I wasn't inclined to join the Hare Krishna movement because there are a bunch of fanatics out there. You know, the Hare Krishna. The worst thing about, the thing that actually turned me off the most about the Hare Krishna movement is that they would always ask for donations. Because you go out in the street, you know, you just like, you get it, you're out in the street and you're just walking and doing something and then some Hare Krishna comes to you and says, "We do stickers or flowers or buckets or something?"
Books.
Books. Well, books are all right. But anyway, he comes to you, gives you a sweet ball, and you think, oh, what a nice person. And then he says, give me money. I said, oh, no, they got me again. Anyway, so... so... I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that was my experience before I joined. But it was Prabhupada's love, Prabhupada's compassion that really convinced me to take up Krishna consciousness. That's really what, that was it, you know. I said, here's the real thing. You know, the real thing was Prabhupada. So any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Mark, you were mentioning about how love is, like, how you should, like, be compassionate loving someone even when they're causing you pain.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't mean you have to listen to them. It's a little bit different. It's not that someone's causing you pain, they do whatever they say. No, that's a little different.
Understand this person, but I have this idea that that's actually wrong. Like, somebody does something wrong, shouldn't
then it's your business to correct it. Yeah, if you love someone, if they're doing something that's harmful to themselves, you'll correct it or attempt to.
How can you do that, though, without hurting, like in devotional exchanges, without offending or upsetting or...
It takes a lot of practice, a lot of finesse. It takes a lot of finesse. You have to just put a straw in your teeth and say... And basically appreciate... Actually, how to correct someone, you have to appreciate why they're doing something wrong. You know, what is their actual motive? And it's not usually a bad motive. It's just that they're trying to fulfill their needs and their strategies are off. People act in this world to fulfill needs, but they don't have good strategies. That's the difference. Well, we have a need for happiness, we have a need for love, but our strategies are actually misplaced. So that's, if you appreciate their needs, then you can help them with their strategies. Or the best thing is you help them develop a better strategy. Because if someone's going to do something or have a strategy, they should own the strategy. You understand what I mean? If they don't own it, if you say, like, the problem with most people when they give advice is they tell people what to do.
People don't like that.
And people don't like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone says, you know, I'm in distress, then you say, be happy. You know, it doesn't work, you know.
No.
You know, I'm in anxiety. Calm down. You know, it just causes the person more anxiety, you know. Now they're angry at you, you know, because you told them to calm down. In addition, they were in anxiety because of whatever reason they were in anxiety before. So advising people, really, it doesn't work. And also, another thing is, you know, if someone comes to you and says, you know, I'm in distress, and then you tell a story about yourself, that doesn't work either. Then you say, well, it's just like the other day, you know, I was in distress too, and I went bungee jumping, and it really helped. You know, so people don't relate. What people want is actually compassion or empathy. You know, they want understanding. So if we understand people, we can help them understand what is the best strategy for themselves to fulfill their needs.
Best thing to do sometimes is just listen.
Yeah, listening.
Yeah, don't actually say much at all.
Yeah, they actually, there's a saying that God gave us two ears and one mouth. So the ears are meant to be used twice as much as the one mouth. But people use the mouth sometimes 10 times as much as than the ears. Anyway, so yes, we should try to help people, but we have to help people help themselves. Isn't it? That's the basic thing. We can't really tell people what to do. Yeah.
What about the situation where, like, it's you personally feel like I'm hurt about this? So you want to love that person, like what you suggested is great if you're really selfless. All I want to do is help that person. But what if you're thinking, someone in my situation shouldn't have to put up with this kind of thing. So I want to help this person not to do it to someone else, but also I feel for myself. I shouldn't speak up or I shouldn't...
No, you have to protect yourself too. There's two things. Unless you're actually taking care of your own needs, you won't be able to take care of other people's needs. Yeah, it just works like that. Like if you have like pressing needs. I mean, for example, if let's say if someone's advising someone and they have to go to the bathroom or something like that, it's a pressing need. You can't really help someone at that point, can you? You're just thinking, you know, when is this going to be over? I hope there's a bathroom nearby or something like that. So, isn't it? I mean, it's practical. Or if you're really hungry, that's a more practical example. Like you haven't eaten and your stomach is growling, raw or something like that. Then you have to satisfy. So we have different varieties of needs. We have basic physical needs, or if you can't breathe, you know, that's another thing. We have basic physical needs. We have emotional needs. We have needs for autonomy. Need for autonomy means we have a need to make our own decision in life about things. And you see, the children express that at a certain age. They actually become what the parents say is cheeky. You know, they actually start disobeying or talking back to the parents because they have a need for autonomy. So actually, parents should understand that. You know, they sometimes say about the child is, my child is just being rebellious. And in this way, they're actually not in tune with the child anymore. The child is acting such a way, in such a way, because the child wants to establish its own identity, that's all. It's not that the child is thinking, let me torture my parents. Let me have some... The parent is thinking, the child's thinking like that, right? But the child is just like thinking, I want to make my own decisions in life. What's this big ogre telling me what to do? Because if you look at us from a child's perspective, we're like one of these giants. Try that sometimes. You know, just go down on the ground and look up at someone and see how you feel if someone's yelling at you. So you look, isn't it? We don't appreciate that. You know, sometimes the parents hit the kid or something, you know, little kid like, but this is going whack, whack. It's just like being attacked by someone like as tall as the ceiling. That's perspective. It's called perspective, you know.
Well, I know what you're saying, because sometimes, you know, you see the person that's extraordinarily tall.
Yeah.
You do feel like all of a sudden you're lost in the world. And the difference could only be...
That tall, inches. Yeah.
So imagine from, say, twice that size.
Yeah, with a child. So imagine what, you know, what Ashutosh is experiencing, for example. And he looks at his parents and they're just like giants. So the parents have to be extremely careful how they deal with the kid. You know, that's why the parents should not be hitting the kids. They should see from his perspective. So compassion basically means to see from someone's perspective. But getting back to the point, you have to meet your own needs first before you can be compassionate. Otherwise, you're not going to be balanced. You know, if your own physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual needs are not being met, how can you actually help someone? Right? Does that make sense? Well, what you
proper exchanges, because you're sort of actually sound like you're criticizing that. Well, the way I do it, because I'm hopeless, is to, you know, it sounds like I'm criticizing more than I'm causing trouble. When, like you were saying, we should be having love, and even if it hurt me, you know. So I'm confused how to.
Well, you got to take care of your own. You got to take care of your own needs first. Let's say you're having some interaction with the temple president. Of course, for you it might be easy. You just say, "Hey, I'm pregnant." You're SBO, you mean old guy. Anyways, I mean, people are going to be much more compassionate with a pregnant lady than some mean old temple president. But anyway, basically getting, you know, speaking seriously. Let's say the temple president or authority figure, let's make it a general thing, is acting in such a way that's stimulating, you know, certain emotions in you that are not so pleasant. So before interacting with him or being able to feel compassion towards him, you've got to deal with your own stuff. And the first way, this is what I prescribe. First thing to do is really take responsibility for your own feelings. That this temple president or this authority is saying this, and I'm feeling this, whatever way you're feeling, because my own needs are not being met. You know, I have a need for authentic interaction, I have a need for compassion, and so my needs are not being met by this person. But you've got to take yourself away from the situation first. The problem is that most people, they want to just jump back into the situation immediately. But you need a time out. You know, everybody needs a time out, especially when some, like, really heavy emotions are coming out. You need to just, like, take a time out and say, well, some heavy emotions are coming out, we'll see you in about a half an hour. And you process your own feelings. And then when you're able to process your feelings and be empathic with yourself, actually empathy begins with yourself, then you're able to understand why the other person is acting the way he's acting and be compassionate. He's acting the way he's acting because he's in anxiety. Maybe the temple president's in anxiety because the finances of the temple are running out. You know, maybe, you know. You know, so instead of seeing someone in a derogatory fashion, you actually look at the person and say, well, he's in anxiety because there's no one to do the RT tonight or whatever. And he really wants to serve the deities. And then you begin to appreciate him. And then you can come back to him and approach him empathically. Once you're balanced, once you actually can pretty much understand what's happening with him, then you can actually approach him compassionately. Like we mentioned, there was a quote the other night I gave by a great Indian philosopher. He said, you know, violence or, you know, conflict comes because of a failure of imagination. You know, because we can't really put ourselves in other people's shoes. If we can put ourselves in other people's, of course, we have to take care of ourselves first. But if we can put ourselves in other people's shoes, then, you know, use our imagination. You know, why is Rupa acting the way he's acting, for example? You know, I'm just making a joke about it, though. You know, and just say, you know, put yourself in his shoes. What has he gone through? What is his life like? What is he feeling? Then you can be compassionate with him, isn't it? Until you can do that role-playing, you can't really exhibit compassion until you can actually, you know, in your mind at least, role-play with someone else. Anyway, this is a little advanced stuff for Bhagavatam class. So, any other questions or comments?
So, if you see two people in such a situation and you're independent, or you're that person who's seeing this, and if you do want to help, how do you approach either and help?
To approach the person you want to help?
If you see two people who are, for example, in distress about something.
Two close friends.
Yeah.
Well, and you're the third person.
Yeah,
there's
different ways to do it. And according to standard mediation, I mean, now you're getting into something like material skills, but according to standard mediation, you would be an impartial mediator between them and have one of them speak his piece while the other one shut up, and then go back and have the second one speak his piece while the other one shut up, and then you go back and forth. That's standard mediation. But what I would do is that I would ultimately have each person play the other person's part and talk to each other as the other person, which is really...
Reverse their own roles.
Yeah, they reverse the roles. I would have them reverse the roles. And they couldn't do that. I mean, if it was such an intense situation, then I would take one person's role and deal with them apart, separately, like that.
What if the one person is, for example, like a temple president?
What? What if he is?
Okay, so it's still... Okay.
Yeah, you take his role. Okay. Yeah, then it works very well. And in authority structures, that works very well.
It doesn't matter whether you deal with an authority figure and just an ordinary figure.
Yeah.
The situation remains the same.
Situation is the same.
The level of those two people doesn't...
Yeah, matter. Because you have to put yourself in the shoes. The best CEOs of corporations get down on the floor with the people sometimes and work along with the, you know, the regular workers.
Yeah.
And they have the best, like, spirit in the corporations when people do that.
I guess the hardest thing is for the person down there to try and explain to him what...
Well, that's why they had, if they reverse roles, it's a very effective technique, you know, for understanding each other.
Because most people in the bottom figure think the employer is the lucky guy
here. Yeah.
He makes lots of money and does nothing for it. For example, that's
a
common sort of comparison they do to me. So you're lucky, you aim all this, you make lots of money, you don't look like you do much, the workers do all the work. But then you explain to them what your position that you're in, yourself, to what responsibilities you have. And you go home at the end of the day and you sleep. You know, I've still got to worry about whether I make the sales or things continue, and breaks and so on. Oh, I didn't realize there was so much in it. The attitudes change.
Yeah.
They see it differently.
Yeah, they need to see from the other person's perspective, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you may even do like a play, like a role play. Mm-hmm. And say, all right, now you're me, and I'm you.
You do my job and I'll do yours.
Or just like in a room like that. Yeah. You know, in a room like, let's hear what you're in my position now, so how are you feeling?
Yeah.
And so that's very effective to understand someone else, to actually switch roles. But that has to be done with a professional mediator or someone who can do that. Yeah.
Sometimes we see people, they're in a different ashram where they have a different mentality and they actually just really renounce. They're like, yeah, what's the big deal? You know, I'm in your position. That's no problem. I can deal with it. But you might be someone who isn't so renounced and, like, for example, wouldn't just sleep on the floor and need it.
That's right.
You know, like in my position, you need some comforts or something. So, but they can't, because they're in that ashram, they, you know, they just think, oh, I wouldn't care. If I was in your position, I wouldn't care.
So therefore, let them do some role playing, see what happens.
Wouldn't that mean they need to be able to imagine how you...
Yes, imagination.
So they use their imagination and say, if I was like that...
No, to actually do it, not just say, if I was like that, all right, you are like that. Like, I'm Krishna Rupa now.
But it's hard to imagine someone else's position.
It's hard, but you can do it. It's not, I've gone through a lot of exercises like that. It's really not that hard, actually. If you're meeting in the room and you hear someone, all right, now you are so-and-so. And you reverse the roles. I mean, there's many types of role-playing you can do. And it's very effective to understanding a particular individual when you have role-playing. In many corporations, they do that, too. They do role-playing so that people will understand, you know, what the other person is going through and be compassionate. It sounds hard, but it's actually, it works very, very well.
It would almost resolve most issues with everybody.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be a situation that you couldn't use that.
If the person would agree to do it, it has to be voluntary.
That's the blast.
What I've seen in many circumstances, people just say, all this New Age garbage, you know, I'm not going to do any of that stuff. I hate you anyway. But anyway, so...
that person just don't want to be helped again.
All these different tools have to be used in a voluntary fashion.
They have to participate.
Yeah, you have to be voluntary. It has to be voluntary fashion. But it's very effective. It's very, very effective, yeah.
So if the wife's nagging the husband, the husband can take
Is that a point? Is that a pointed question?
The husband can take the role of nagging.
Do we want to do marriage counseling right in the middle of Bhagavatam class?
Yeah, Rupa could be pregnant.
I mean, well, here's a pillow, Rupa. You know. No, but it can be. You know, just you use your imagination. Violence comes because of a failure of imagination. I mean, just to the extent, let's say Hitler in World War II. I mean, he couldn't put himself in the position of the people he was hurting by his policies, right? For example, people know I'm a vegan, you know, and Joseph vegan too. Anyway, so one of the
give you a hard time for it. Trust
yeah, they, people give you a hard time. In the Hare Krishna movement, they especially give you a hard time.
Yeah.
They call you a demon. At least you haven't been called a demon yet. But
I've been called plenty of things that I haven't heard about.
So, the reason is I sort of put myself in the position of a cow. I thought, you know, what is the cow experiencing? That's compassion.
Yeah.
When the cow is in the dairy, and they're being marched into this, you know, the milking parlor, and these things attached to the udder, and they're sucking, you know, like vacuum pumps, sucking the milk out of them, even though they want to give it, don't want to give it. And then they're like in a factory. It's like a concentration camp, right? If you actually, so I use my imagination to picture what it would be like to be a cow like that. And then they'd leave, and then they, if you don't give enough milk, you're killed and turned into hamburger meat or something? Isn't that hellish?
Yeah, it is.
You think about it. I mean, imagine living like that in a situation where, you know, you're living with your family, but your family really is just trying to get money from you and everything from you. They don't really love you. It's just how much money you produce. And as soon as you cannot give them enough money or the amount of money comes down,
they turn you into hamburger
meat. Yeah, you know, no, it's happened in civilization. It's probably called a love feast where they take the elder members of the family and they eat them.
Oh, that'd be rough.
Yeah, that'd be rough, you know. Or, you know, even, of course, it's not done nowadays, but they just kick you out of the house.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen.
Throw you off the roof.
Yeah, throw you off the roof. Or kick you out of the house. I mean, it happens with the widows in Vrindavan. With the women. I mean, there's so many widows in Vrindavan. They were serving their families faithfully. Their husbands died, and their husband's family just kicks them out. And then they just say, go to Vrindavan, have a spiritual experience. And then these ladies, there's tens of thousands of ladies hanging around Vrindavan who were kicked out of their homes by their husband's family when the husband died. So it's the same thing as the cow, you know, in a different fashion, like that. So I'm thinking about that, and then when I think about putting myself in the cow's position, then I feel compassionate towards the cow, and I can't take milk anymore. I'm not saying that none of you should take milk. I'm just saying that's my own personal experience. So compassion arises when we can actually put ourselves in the other person's position. Does that make sense? Yeah.
The second example yesterday, just like if you try and generally express your views for the common good, but the person takes upon himself that there might be directing it towards him, how to deal with them that no, actually I'm not directing my views.
That happens, there's always misunderstandings. Then that happens. I mean, we just have to explain to the person I wasn't attacking you, you know, I was just making a general philosophical statement. That happened the other day with us. But that's life. There's always misunderstandings in this world. It's hard to avoid. All right, I think we have to end because we got things to do, right? So, we got a lot of people watching this morning on TV land. Okay, all glorious divine grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai. Yeah.
No response.
No response. All right. What can be done?
I might try again today.
Yeah, and I'm a ramen and everything like that.